I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
We were hoping they'd be home. Not.
Several hours after the fire started at the Savopoulos house, Darren was back in Lanham searching on his old hand-me-down LG phone for information about iPhones.
That murder trial is a play. So you do think about the theatrics of everything you do. You have to.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. It's 11 o'clock in Brooklyn on a cool Wednesday night in late May. The kind of weather where you could sleep with the windows open. Darren Wint is lying on the bed next to his fiancée, Vanessa, winding down when the local news comes on. 6 days earlier, emergency responders rushed to a burning home hundreds of miles away in Washington, D.C. The investigation into who killed four people there was underway, and the story of that crime was starting to make national news. But the world didn't know Darren Wint's name yet. He was not the man convicted in a quadruple murder. He hadn't been accused of killing a 10-year-old boy. He wasn't even a suspect in the crime. He was just an out-of-work welder from Maryland who hopped on a bus to go visit his girlfriend in New York. Vanessa Hales knew things had been tough lately for Darren, or Dylan, as she called him. As his longtime girlfriend, she knew that he was tired of bouncing around living with family members. Darren had just moved in with his dad after he was kicked out of his brother Stefan's house. So Darren and Vanessa were in a long-distance relationship and mostly kept in touch on Facebook. It's actually where they first met. Darren saw her tagged in a family member's photo and decided to message her. Soon they were spending hours every day chatting. Vanessa knew him as Dylan because Darren went by his middle name on Facebook. A few months earlier, Darren proposed to Vanessa. He told her he couldn't afford to get her a ring. But she didn't care. She said yes anyway. Vanessa was the best thing in Darren's life. He was out of work, with a rundown minivan, and no place of his own. But before he came to New York, it appeared Darren's luck had suddenly changed. He was flush with cash. Remember how Darren was having problems navigating the process of renewing his green card? Well, the day before he left for New York, he went to an immigration attorney in suburban Maryland and dropped $1,100 on legal fees to get it sorted out. He could finally afford the expert he needed to get his citizenship status back on track. That day, Darren texted Vanessa a picture of the receipt from the immigration attorney's office. It said, "All for you." And get this, during that appointment, 2 days after the killings on Woodland Drive, Darren agreed to give his fingerprints for an FBI background check. When Darren got to New York, he continued to spend. He took Vanessa out shopping. He took her to dinner, bought her groceries, and gave her money to pay her rent. And he paid for it all in $100 bills. Where did the money come from? Didn't she wonder? Well, Darren gave her some explanation. He told Vanessa that he'd sold his van for several hundred bucks and that he finally had hit it big. He'd won the lottery. It's the same story he told Godfrey, his sister's boyfriend, when they were at the gym a few days earlier, when Darren flashed that big wad of cash. Everyone in his life knew that Darren played the lottery. He was obsessed with numbers. And now it seemed like he'd finally picked the winning combination. But something was weighing on Darren's mind while he was enjoying New York with his fiance. We can tell from what he was searching for on his phone. On May 18th, the day after he arrived in New York, and 4 days after the fire on Woodland Drive, Darren started searching for the websites of local D.C. news stations. The Manson murders, as they were called, was still the top story. His next search, 10 hideout cities for fugitives. Then, 5 countries with no U.S. extradition treaty. Around the same time, in between searches for extradition treaties and news clips about the fire, Darren searched for First 48 D.C. Jack and I pored through pages and pages of his phone messages and search history. We've already told you that Darren's phone history was introduced as evidence in his trial. But this search, First 48 D.C., stuck out to us. We think it's a reference to the true crime series on A&E called The First 48. Maybe you've heard of it. Basically, camera crews follow police departments around in major American cities, documenting the initial hours of murder investigations. The show helped popularize the theory that detectives have 48 hours to develop a lead before their chance of solving a case drops dramatically. We wondered if Darren was trying to reassure himself that his luck would hold by searching for the First 48 DC. At this point, it had been far more than 48 hours since the killings on Woodland Drive. It had been 96 hours. But 2 days after those searches, as he lay in bed next to his fiance, Darren's luck runs out. The TV screen lights up the bedroom with the story of the mysterious murders of 4 people in Washington, D.C. There's just been a major break in the case. Police have identified a suspect. A few pictures of him flash on the screen. And one of them is a gym selfie. Vanessa jumps out of bed. She says, "Dylan, that's you." We heard the story of how Darren Wint learned he was wanted for murder from his fiance. Vanessa took the stand during his murder trial. She spoke in a quiet voice and cried softly throughout her testimony. Sitting in the witness chair, she looked defeated, almost like she was trying to make herself smaller, like she wanted to disappear. When she was asked to make an in-court identification to point out the defendant, Vanessa was barely able to extend her arm in Darren's direction. And then she broke down crying. They were no longer in a romantic relationship, but Vanessa said she still cared about what happened to him. But Vanessa was testifying for the prosecution. In fact, she'd been given immunity for her testimony. Prosecutors arranged for an attorney and agreed they would not charge her with anything in connection with her testimony. What could she be charged with? Well, after they saw his face on TV that night, Darren and Vanessa decided to leave the apartment to get away from where the police might find them. They fled together. Vanessa went with Darren to a hotel that night, missing the NYPD who swarmed her Brooklyn apartment within minutes of the news report. The next morning, Darren took a taxi back to the D.C. area. He told Vanessa he was turning himself in. But before he left, he gave her more money. And she spent it. We tried tracking down Vanessa Hales to interview her for this podcast. We tried messaging her on Facebook. We also contacted her attorney here in D.C. to pass along our request. But in the end, her attorney said she didn't want to speak with us. Vanessa was the person Darren was closest to in the spring of 2015. When she testified, we wondered if the details of her testimony would give us the closest insight into understanding him. But we didn't know what was coming next.
We begin with a rather big development from the trial of the suspected killer of the Savopoulos family and their housekeeper. That man took the stand in his own trial.
That's what listeners heard on WTOP, the radio station Jack and I work for here in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Oh, my God. Go.
That's what was going on behind the scenes when I called Jack, astonished that Darren Wendt would be testifying in his own defense. It was a month into his trial. The medical examiner had just finished her testimony, detailing the victim's gruesome injuries, and the prosecution rested its case.
When did you find out that he was going to testify?
We found out at the end of the morning break when they were going into the defense beginning. And they said, we have one witness before we have Darren Wendt as our second witness.
When they said we have one witness before Darren Wendt, what was the reaction among the reporters and other people in the room?
People were kind of turning to each other. I mean, Paul Wagner from Channel 5 turned to me and goes, did I hear that right? And I said, yeah. So I think people were sort of like, it was not shocking. I mean, there was always a possibility he was going to testify, but we just didn't know.
From day one of the trial, Darren Wendt's lawyers proclaimed his complete and total innocence. They said that because this case was so horrible and so high profile, there had been a rush to judgment. In his opening statement, one of Darren Wendt's attorneys, Jeffrey Stein, said, when something this tragic happens, we all have the urge to hold someone responsible. Darren Wendt is not responsible for these crimes. And from the beginning, Darren's lawyers claimed it was actually his two younger brothers who took the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa captive and then killed them. Jeffrey Stein said, Darren's brothers deceived him, abandoned him, and left him to take the fall. Now, with Darren taking the stand, we'd finally get to hear his defense in his own words, laid out step by step. Hi, guys. Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around D.C. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out The DMV Download. Thanks. Darren's story doesn't begin on Wednesday, May 13th, when he disappeared from his dad's house in Lanham, Maryland. It actually starts 2 days earlier, on Monday, May 11th. During his testimony, Darren said that day he decided to drive to Tacoma Park in neighboring Montgomery County, Maryland, to visit his half-brother, Darrell. A quick note, you're going to hear a lot about what Darren says happened, about what he claims his brothers did. But remember, prosecutors maintain both of Darren's younger brothers are completely innocent. Keep that in mind as we lay out Darren's story. In a later episode, you'll be hearing more about Darrell and Stefan's whereabouts in May 2015 and why prosecutors are so certain they were not involved. Okay, so when Darren went to go see Darrell, it wasn't a planned visit. He said he just decided to pop up there. And when he was there, he said Darrell offered him a job. According to Darren, Darrell said he and their other brother, Stefan, were doing a painting and drywall job that Wednesday, 2 days later, and that they'd pay Darren if he'd help out. Stefan worked as a manager at a construction company, but Darren said he got the impression they were proposing an off-the-books kind of job. Darren said he'd never worked a side job with his brothers before, but he could use the cash. The plan was to meet up early that Wednesday morning near where Stefan worked, a construction shop called PCM Services in Prince George's County, Maryland. Darren said he was in. So on May 13th, Darren said he woke up early, like usual, except this time he wasn't looking for work. He had a job to go to. Darren said he was waiting for his brothers outside the construction shop when Darrell, just Darrell, walked up to his van and told him there had been a change of plans. They no longer needed Darren's help after all. They just wanted to borrow his van, and they'd pay him for it, $300. Darren said he was disappointed he wouldn't be working, but he handed Darrell the keys to his van anyway. First, Darren said Darrell drove him to a house in Silver Spring, Maryland. Darren testified he didn't know this house. He'd never been there before. Darrell went inside for a few minutes and then came back out. We'll tell you more about that visit later, but just know that that stop is going to be crucial to Darren's defense. And then after stopping at the house in Silver Spring, Darren said Darrell didn't drop him off back at his dad's house. We already heard his stepmother testify that Darren was nowhere to be found on May 13th and 14th of 2015. Darren testified that he asked Darrell to drop him off at Ed's house. But who's Ed? That was a name we'd never heard before. Not in opening statements, not in the three-year-long police investigation leading up to Darren Wynn's trial. All of the reporters in the courtroom perked up when Darren mentioned Ed. An alibi witness for Darren Wynn? This seemed like a potentially major revelation. So, who is Ed? Darren said Ed was an older guy who lived in Southeast D.C., behind a tire shop on Atlantic Street. He said Ed had worked on his van a couple times, and he knew Ed's was sort of a hangout spot. So, with the job falling through and nothing else to do that day, he decided to go there. Now, remember, we've already told you that Darren's normally active Facebook account went completely silent starting May 13th. Here's his explanation for that. Darren said Darrell drove him to Ed's house. He hopped out of the van, and Darrell drove off, before Darren realized he'd left his cell phone inside the van. Darren said he was basically stuck at Ed's house. He didn't have any way of contacting his brothers, and he wasn't expecting Darrell to come back to pick him up until about 5 or 6 that night. But that time came and went. He said Darrell never showed. At some point that evening, Darren said Ed offered him a drink. Ed was smoking marijuana, which Darren said he didn't do. But he did take Ed up on his offer for a drink. He thought it was vodka. The next thing he knew, he started to feel sick and went to lie down on the couch inside Ed's house. Basically, he said, he passed out. He said he woke up sometime in the middle of the night, around 1 a.m., and then fell back asleep. The next time he woke up, it was after 10 in the morning. Darren said he went outside, and then a blue convertible Porsche pulled up. Darrell was behind the wheel. At this point in Darren's testimony, the court took a break for lunch, so I quickly snapped a picture of my notes, emailed them to Jack, and then gave him a call to catch him up on Darren's testimony.
I mean, who is this person, Ed? Is the address the 16 Atlantic Street? That's where he said
yeah.
It was?
We had a lot of questions. If this was true, Ed could take the stand and provide an alibi for Darren for part of May 13th and 14th, when the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were held captive and then killed. As reporters, Jack and I were trying to keep an open mind, but we kind of wondered whether Ed was even real. No one had ever heard of this person before, and Ed sounded kind of generic. We didn't even know his last name.
It's very convenient that he was at a friend's house without a phone, drunk, and passed out when the majority of this was happening. And maybe they're going to call Ed as one of their witnesses.
At this point, Jack was only reading my notes from Darren Wynn's testimony. He wasn't in the courtroom. So I did my best to describe what Darren was like on the stand.
After the jury was out of the courtroom, the judge was like, you really need to speak up. Like, we can't understand what you're saying. You're mumbling. You really need to speak up, which I thought was interesting. I mean, he was mumbling a little bit, but it's sort of the way he talks. He kind of has like a, almost like a fry in his voice. Like, it kind of, I don't know. It is low. I think he's nervous too, because he keeps wiping his eyes, and I don't know if he's not like crying. Like, there's no respiratory, there's no breathing in deeply or any kind of like pitch in his voice or anything, but he keeps wiping his eyes. And Judy Pivot asked him at one point, are you okay? And he said, yes, ma'am. But I honestly think it's because he's so nervous, maybe.
Okay, back to Darren's story. Before we broke for lunch, Darren had told the courtroom that on the morning of May 14th, he walked out of Ed's house and saw Darrell drive up in that fancy Porsche. Darren was a little fuzzy on the time, but he said it was definitely sometime after 10 in the morning. Now, we already know, based on some of the other evidence we've told you, about how on that same morning, at 11:47, Darren typed 24th and K into his phone. What was his explanation for that? Darren said when Darrell pulled up in that Porsche, he handed Darren his phone. The phone, Darren said, he'd left in the van the day before. And when Darren asked where his van was, he said Darrell told him it was parked at 24th and K Streets in downtown D.C. Darren said he typed those cross streets into an empty message bubble on his phone so he wouldn't forget. So they pull away in the Porsche. Darren said he thought Darrell was taking him to his van. But once inside, he said Darrell told him they actually still had some work to finish up, and he needed Darren's help. Darren said he was feeling hungover. He was starving. He still hadn't eaten anything. But he said Darrell wouldn't stop for food. He said there'd be food where they were going, which turned out to be Woodland Drive. When they got there, Darren said Darrell parked in front of the house, and they both walked right in the front door. Once inside, Darren said he turned to the left and went into this fancy-looking sitting room. He waited there while his brother Darrell went upstairs. When he came back down, Darrell was carrying a box of Domino's pizza. Darren said he ate a slice of the cold pepperoni pizza, all except the crust, which was cold and hard, and he left that in the box. At this moment in his testimony, I hit pause on my furious note-taking, realizing that Darren Wendt was admitting he was inside the Savopoulos' house. He was admitting he ate the pizza. He said that's the reason his DNA turned up there, because he had touched it. Back to his testimony. Darren said when he was inside the house on Woodland Drive, he didn't hear anything out of the ordinary. No screams for help. No scraping of chairs on the floors. He said he didn't have the feeling anyone else was in the house. Nothing out of the ordinary at all. Well, there was one weird thing. And it goes back to the pizza. He said when Darrell handed him the pizza, he saw he was wearing these thick construction gloves. Darren said that struck him as odd. And he said he was kind of annoyed by it, like, why are you touching my food with your dirty gloves? As he was sitting there, Darren said he realized he'd left his phone back in the Porsche. And then he went back out the front door to get it. Before he stepped outside, his brother told him, on his way back, to come through the garage. So Darren said he went to the Porsche to get his phone and his black drawstring backpack, which he realized he'd also left inside the car. And then he walked around to the side of the house to the garage. The two automatic garage doors were closed, he said. But as he approached the one on the right side, it opened for him, and he slipped under the opening door. Darren testified that was around noon on Thursday, May 14th, the exact time those two workers at the residence of the Australian ambassador across the street saw a man matching Darren's description ducking under the garage door. You might remember from the episode where we laid out all the forensic evidence that a key piece of evidence linking Darren Wendt to the crime was found in the garage, a construction helmet lying on the floor with a single broken hair inside matching Darren Wendt. When Darren took the stand, he had an explanation for that too. Darren said Darrell met him inside the garage and handed him a construction helmet and a lime green construction vest and told him to put it on. Darren said he thought that was weird. You don't normally wear construction gear for a residential painting job. That's when he said Darrell, who had also put on a construction vest, told him they'd be unloading the house, and he didn't want them to stick out. Darren testified he knew what unloading meant. Stealing. He said he told Darrell he didn't want any part of that. He just wanted Darrell to take him to his van. But Darrell refused, and he told Darren he still needed his help. Darren said he got so frustrated, he pulled the hard hat off of his head and he threw it on the floor of the garage and stormed out. He said he started walking away from the house, turned down the first side street he came to, and just kept walking, looking for a bus stop or a metro stop or any other way to get home. Darren said he was so angry, he didn't realize he was still wearing the construction vest. And then, all of a sudden, that blue Porsche pulled up alongside him. Darrell was behind the wheel again. He told Darren to get in. He'd take him to his van. But first, they had to make a stop in Maryland. Darren's version of events puts the Porsche on New York Avenue, heading into Maryland, around the time the eyewitness saw the Porsche there on May 14th. But in Darren's telling, the person driving the Porsche on New York Avenue was Darrell, not him. The witness didn't say anything about seeing someone else in the car. But Darren said he was in the passenger seat, he still wasn't feeling very well, and reclined the seat all the way. But is it possible Darrell Wendt was driving the Porsche, based on the witness description? Remember, that witness, Andrew Zeron, said he thought the driver of the Porsche was pretty slim, or petite, as he said. That description didn't fit Darren Wendt. But it really doesn't fit Darrell Wendt either. In fact, Darrell is taller than Darren, and also has a pretty solid build. But here's the thing. Darrell does have short hair, just like the witness saw. So Darren said Darrell's going to drive him to his van, but first he has to make a stop in Maryland. It turned out to be the parking lot in Prince George's County near LaFontaine Blue Shopping Center. As we've said, that wasn't an unfamiliar area to Darren. Just steps away from the parking lot is the apartment complex where he lived with his sister for years. And Darren's other brother, Stefan, also lived nearby. When they got to the parking lot, Darren said Darrell had changed his mind again. He couldn't take Darren to his van after all. But, Darren said, his brother handed him the $300 for borrowing the van and two white iPhones. Darren said he was really frustrated that Darrell wasn't taking him to his van. How was he going to get there? So frustrated, he said, that when he was getting out of the Porsche, he pulled off that lime green construction vest and threw it at Darrell, who was still sitting in the driver's seat. Then, he said, Darrell drove off, and within seconds, Darren realized he didn't have the keys to his van. So he said that's why he flagged down that tow truck driver and directed him to 24th and K Streets in downtown D.C. He paid the driver $100 from the $300 he got from Darrell. And yes, he did use the tow truck driver's phone to make calls and send messages. Darren said he was trying to get back in touch with Darrell to get the keys to his van. Then, just like the tow truck driver testified, Darren had it towed back to the parking lot in Prince George's County. But why would he tow it back to that parking lot near LaFontaine Blue? Darren said before Darrell drove off, his brother told him he was planning on being back in that area later that day to meet a friend. So Darren said he decided to have his van towed back there to wait for Darrell, since he said he didn't have the keys. It turned out he didn't end up needing his brother after all. While he was waiting there, Darren went looking in his van for a cigarette. When he popped open the glove compartment, he said he found the keys inside. He didn't know it, but Darren said the keys had been there the whole time. He'd had the van towed for nothing. He said he popped the keys in the ignition and drove back to his dad's house. Later that evening, after Darren got back home, after he and his dad had that argument about where he'd been, Darren said he happened to catch a glimpse of the news, something about a fire in D.C., on Woodland Drive, at the house where he said Darrell had taken him for that bogus painting and drywall job, the same house where he ate that slice of pizza. Darren said he was shocked. He pulled out his phone and searched how to beat a lie detector.
Okay, so I've read through your notes. So
oh, my God, 10 pages of notes.
Okay, but so just tell me, what is your takeaway?
I think he was very well coached. I think they accounted for, like, the majority of it. There were a couple of things that sort of didn't add up. But for the most part, he seemed, at least to me, maybe I'm gullible, but he seemed very believable to me. It doesn't seem like he had much of a life here. I mean, he didn't have many friends. He had his girlfriend who he was always talking to in New York, and he didn't really trust his brothers that much and wasn't really close to his brothers, and he desperately needed money. What was your takeaway? What do you think?
Well, I had to read the notes a couple times to try to figure out, you know, trying to figure out exactly. I mean, it's a perfect puzzle piece. It fits right in.
I know.
But the thing is, but actually, so there's a way that makes me kind of suspicious of that.
Remember, by the time Darren's testifying, he'd listened to the prosecution lay out its entire case. So, theoretically, he could make his story fit in all of the evidence they had against him. Laura Bach would accuse him of doing just that later in her cross-examination. But there were a few things that didn't seem to fit. Remember that knife in the basement window with the incredibly small traces of his DNA on it? In Darren's story, he never went into the basement. He never went upstairs, either. So that knife in the basement sticks out. It can't be explained by anything in Darren's story. Maybe that's why his lawyers tried so hard to challenge the forensic evidence, to challenge the idea Darren ever touched that knife. Still, we just heard weeks and weeks of testimony from the prosecution's witnesses. We had some details of the prosecution's case going in, but until Darren took the stand, the defense's case was a mystery.
This is why, I mean, from the beginning, we've been looking forward to the defense because that's where the fireworks are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like anything can happen now, and that's why everybody, I'm like, Jeff, the entire courtroom filled up to the brim.
And the growing crowd in the gallery was in for a show as Laura Bach prepared to launch her cross-examination of Darren Wendt. Now, before we get into the cross-examination, we need to recap a few other key things Darren said on the stand when he was being questioned by his lawyer, Judy Pipe. For example, those two white iPhones that Darren said Darrell gave him in the LaFontaine Blue parking lot. Remember, Darren said he'd just gotten into an argument with his brother over stealing from the Savopoulos house. Why would he then willingly take these iPhones? Darren said Darrell told him those phones didn't come from the house. He found them in a park. And Darren said he believed him. Then later that night, after Darren went back home to his dad's house, after he said he learned that the house he was in earlier that day had caught on fire and four people had died inside, Darren said he met back up with Darrell. They went to Walmart. Now, by the time Darren testified, we already knew Darren and Darrell went to Walmart that night because prosecutors had tracked down surveillance video from the store and played it for the jury. In fact, the brothers actually made two trips to Walmart that night, one shortly before 10:30, and then another trip about an hour later at 11:30. We'll detail what happened during those trips in a later episode. For now, what's important is that during those Walmart trips, Darren said he kept asking Darrell about the fire on Woodland Drive, but his brother wouldn't tell him anything. Darren said he was worried about his van being linked to the fire, which is why, he said, he looked up how to beat a lie detector test. Then Darren testified, Darrell decided to give him even more money for borrowing his van. A lot more. $6,000. Then there's the conversation with Godfrey, Darren's sister's boyfriend. Remember Darren asked Godfrey to help him burn his van? Darren told his lawyer he did call Godfrey that night, and he did ask him to help burn his van. Again, he said he was worried about what Darrell had gotten him into and that it could be traced back to him. But Darren said he never ended up going through with it. He said he went to bed that night with his van parked in front of his dad's house. When he woke up the next morning, the van had disappeared. He said he thought Darrell had taken care of it. Now, as we already said, Darren's minivan did end up burned. It was found on fire in an industrial area of Prince George's County. Warehouses, empty lots. There's a storage lot for school buses right there. It was found on fire shortly after midnight on May 16th, 2015. The same night, Darren talked to Godfrey about burning it. Police knew this area as one where, strangely enough, people tended to burn cars. It was also right around the corner from Metal Fab, the metalworking shop where Darren used to work. But Darren said he had nothing to do with burning his van.
This is super weird. He called Godfrey to burn the van. Godfrey says no. And the next day the van is gone and then it ends up burned and he had nothing to do with it.
Okay, so here's the thing. You know, a human reaction is I was scared. I thought I might, you know, get involved. So I did burn the van, but I didn't do anything else, you know. That to me is so much more understandable than, yes, I talked about burning the van, but I didn't do it. It just showed up the next day burned. Which I just find totally unbelievable.
No, I completely agree.
But
with that.
To me, it's very psychologically revealing of somebody who is unable to admit any guilt whatsoever about anything, you know?
Again, we're trying to keep an open mind, but it was difficult. As journalists, we're trained to be skeptical. But our skepticism was nothing compared to lead prosecutor Laura Bach when she got the chance to cross-examine Darren Wendt. We've already told you how we tried to get audio recordings of the trial. We couldn't record the proceedings ourselves. It's not allowed in D.C. Superior Court. The court records trials, but those are not considered public record. So we wrote to the chief judge, and he decided to review the court's policies on releasing recordings. In April, we got word that Chief Judge Robert Morin was speaking at a legal conference here in D.C. So we went, and we snagged him for a quick interview to ask him about our request.
Nice to meet you. I had to ask you, thank you for launching the review into the audio transcripts.
Yes. Oh, no, no.
That's our outlet. Is there any idea, like, how, like, what the timeline might be for that?
That's really good work.
If it's next year, then that helps me plan.
Well,
if it's a couple months.
Do you understand that we've had a historical practice for 50 years, and
yeah.
your came in, my people said, you don't release it, and I said, why? I mean, tell me why. Why can't we do this? And so it's under general counsel review. I mean, I'm committing to making a transparent court.
I couldn't be happier about that. And okay, I was so happy to get your letter. I just, you know, that's my job is to kind of figure out.
Yeah, we felt like it was like getting a college acceptance. Because we were reading
Well, no. You're on the wait list.
Right. Now, it's a glimmer of hope. That's
okay.
That's what we thought.
But, I mean, give us some time because there's a lot of processes we go through in terms of review of general counsel, review of our systems.
It's been a few months, and we're still on the wait list. Maybe one day the recordings from Darren Wynn's murder trial will be made available. And if we're able, we'll make them available to you so you can hear Darren's testimony in his own voice. For now, we are relying on option two. We ordered transcripts of Darren's testimony from the court. They cost hundreds of dollars, but we paid for them because we want to be able to show word for word what Darren said when Laura Bach stood up from the prosecution table and started grilling him. Even so, we wondered how to present this information. Reenactments can be tricky. We didn't want this to come across as cheesy or cheap. But remember Glenn Kirshner, the former federal prosecutor who knows Laura Bach? He's the one who told us a murder trial is like a play. And it really felt that way. The drama of it all, the cast of characters, and the clash of personalities. And since we don't have the audio recordings, we figured the best way to present it was to have the parts of Laura and Darren read aloud. Our colleagues Lauren Larson and Claude Jennings helped us out. A quick note, these transcripts are 300 pages long. So for the sake of time, we've shortened a few exchanges. For example, where Laura Bach repeated a question. We selected parts of the cross-examination that capture the often intense exchanges between the prosecutor and the defendant, and that show how Darren Wynn stuck to his narrative of what he said happened. You're not going to hear every yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. But nothing that we shortened or removed distorts what was said in the courtroom. The six-hour-long cross-examination took place the day after Darren Wynn first took the stand. And because word got out that he was testifying, the courtroom was packed.
Good morning, Mr. Wynn.
Good morning.
So, back in May of 2015, you were 34 years old, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And in terms of the brothers, you're the oldest, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And then there's Stefan, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And then Darrell?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you actually really enjoy kind of tinkering around with numbers on computers and stuff like that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You like kind of plugging them in and seeing where they fit in terms of figuring out patterns and things?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and I guess you also have some street smarts. Is that fair?
Yes, ma'am.
So when your brother said to you about unloading a house, I mean, you knew what he was talking about.
Yes, ma'am.
You didn't have to go look it up on Urban Dictionary?
No, ma'am.
All right, so you're a pretty bright guy.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, you worked at AIW in 2003 is when you started, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
You worked there from May 2003 to April 2005?
Yes, ma'am.
You were terminated from AIW because you weren't going to work, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And to be clear, when you called AIW in 2008 asking for a new job, they wouldn't hire you. Is that right?
They said they wasn't hiring.
Right. They weren't hiring you. Is that right?
No, they just said they wasn't hiring.
And they didn't hire you.
No, they just said they wasn't hiring.
My question is, did they hire you?
No, ma'am.
And the same thing in 2009?
No, ma'am.
Now, just to be clear, the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, you did not have steady work. Is that right?
No, ma'am.
No, that's not right, or no, you didn't have steady work?
No, ma'am, I didn't have steady work.
You had to rely on your family for support, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And so by your family, we're talking about your brother Stefan, right?
I was staying with him.
Okay, and he was giving you money, right?
No, ma'am.
He didn't give you money?
No, ma'am.
Never once?
No, ma'am.
Never gave you a dime?
No, ma'am.
Never gave you a dollar?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my recall. No, ma'am.
Who gave you the phone, that black phone, that LG phone?
It was a phone that he wasn't using anymore, Stefan.
Oh, so Stefan gave you the phone?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, who paid the bill?
It didn't have a bill.
Initially, who paid the bill?
I don't know.
Well, did you pay it?
No, ma'am.
Did the fairies pay it?
At this point, Darren's defense attorney, Judy Pipe, objected. The judge asked Laura Bach to rephrase her question. And she did. But she didn't get much further with Darren. He said he didn't pay for the bill. He didn't know who did. And then Laura Bach wanted to know about how Darren supported himself.
Did your mom give you money?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, did your sisters give you money?
Yes, ma'am. The sisters in Guyana.
Okay, what about your sisters here?
Maybe occasionally, yes.
Samantha give you money?
No.
Never?
Before, yes, she has.
Your dad ever give you money?
I guess.
I guess the bottom line is, you were not in a good spot by the spring of 2015?
No, ma'am.
And you were looking for work, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it's hard for you to find work because you don't have an identification card, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so no driver's license, right?
Yes, ma'am.
No passport, no official ID or anything that you can use?
No, ma'am.
All right, so you're kind of stuck looking for work as a day laborer, right?
Unless somebody hired me with an expired ID.
Okay, but your options are limited, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, we heard your stepmother talking about sort of this routine that you had when you were at their home. And I guess you would agree with me that you had sort of this similar routine where you would get up early in the morning and go looking for work. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, you did go to the gym pretty much all of the time, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And you actually were always kind of taking pictures of yourself and sending them to people that you cared about, right?
Yes, ma'am. Motivating them to do the same thing.
All right. And you bulked up pretty quickly, right?
I thought I was a good size. Yes, ma'am.
All right. And you were pretty impressed with that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The point is, you're not some scrawny little guy, right?
No, ma'am.
In any case, a good prosecutor has to lay the groundwork, has to ask a witness what seem like basic questions. So that's why Laura Bach wanted to know who paid Darren Wint's phone bill and what his gym routine was. The questions about what happened on Woodland Drive would come later. Laura Bach was just getting warmed up. Now, we didn't expect October 11th to be a special day in this trial, but it happened to be the day one of D.C.'s top homicide prosecutors went up against the defendant in one of the city's most high-profile crimes. Darren Wint, the sole suspect in the killings of Sava, Amy, and Philip Savopoulos, and their housekeeper Vera Figueroa, is on the witness stand, sitting quietly, wearing a white shirt and a patterned tie. We pick up the cross-examination as Laura Bach revisits Darren's story of showing up at Durrell's house when he said Durrell told him about the job. She sounds really skeptical.
So you just pop up there and Durrell says, I've got an idea. Let's do something together. Me, you, and Stefan on Wednesday?
No, ma'am.
He doesn't say, I've got a job for us on Wednesday?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, he says, me, you, Stefan, got a job for us on Wednesday, right?
Can you repeat the question?
He says to you, me, you, Stefan, we've got a job on Wednesday. Is that right?
He said him and Stefan have a job for me on Wednesday. Yes, ma'am.
Right. To include you, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Then she wanted to know what happened when he met up with Durrell on the day of the painting job.
All right. Tell us again. What happens on May 13th when you show up at PCM?
I park the van and Durrell come walking up to the van.
Okay, and when Durrell gets up to you, he tells you, sorry, we don't need you anymore, we just need your car. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and at this point you say, I'm all right with that, but I want some money for the car.
Yes, ma'am. I told them as long as they give me $300, they can have the van.
Okay. Now, to be clear, while you're sitting there in that parking lot at PCM, you don't see Stefan, right?
No, ma'am.
Never once?
Never once.
No communications with Stefan about this job, right?
No, ma'am.
And at this point, I mean, you're planning to be gone all day doing this work. Is that right?
Well, how long the work take, I was going to be gone.
All right. How much do you think you were going to get out of that?
Pay-wise?
Yeah.
I thought he was going to pay me some decent money.
What's decent money?
$100 a day.
And instead, you don't make $100, you get told they'll give you $300 just for using your van, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that upset you?
It didn't upset me. I was disappointed that I didn't actually get a chance to work.
You're disappointed that you don't have to do anything and you're going to get paid $300 as opposed to going and busting your butt doing drywall work and getting $100?
Because I just still wanted to do something. I was working.
Oh, because you wanted to work for the $100.
Yes, ma'am.
And again, you think this is legit drywall work, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it didn't strike you as odd that they want to pay you $300 for a minivan?
No.
No, you can rent a truck at Home Depot for $50 and they want to give you $300 for your unregistered minivan. Doesn't that strike you as odd?
No, ma'am.
And you're upset now that you get to not do anything and just get paid $300, right? You're disappointed.
That I didn't get to work. Yes, ma'am.
Right.
So, first of all, Laura Bach is just very aggressive. She's very, like, she's using sort of a higher-pitched voice. She's repeating everything he says. She then repeats it and then says, right?
That's audio of a call from the day Laura Bach cross-examined Darren Wendt. I was trying to set the scene for Jack.
Like, everything is very, obviously, accusatory. I mean, that's obviously a fitting term to use here. But it just, even the most sort of innocuous things that he says are being rephrased in a very combative way. So the tension in the room is just very turned up.
Jack also wanted to know how the jurors were reacting to her aggressive delivery.
They're sort of amused. Some of them are amused by what he's saying, like, because he is doing, I mean, if you think about the fact that he's being coached, he's doing a good job at keeping his calm, even though she's sort of coming at him with this higher tone. Like, it's just human nature to then match that tone, and he's not doing that. He's asking for more specifics when she asks sort of general questions. He doesn't respond generally. He asks for more specifics.
Back to her cross-examination. Laura Bach basically asked Darren to recount the entire story he first laid out for his lawyer when he took the stand the day before. We won't go through it all again. But remember, it's at about this point in his story that Darren said Darrell drove him to Ed's house.
And you go to Ed's house because you're so disappointed that you're going to get $300 for not doing anything, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when you get to Ed's house, how long had you known Ed in 2015?
I can't quite remember how long, but I've known him for a minute.
More than a month?
Yes, ma'am.
More than a year?
No.
So somewhere between 1 month and a year. Is that fair?
Yeah.
And you said Ed had done some work on your minivan before. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Now tell me, Ed, how old was Ed back in 2015?
I don't know his age, but he was old.
He was old?
Yes, ma'am.
You don't know how old?
No, ma'am. I never asked him how old he was.
Ed was 52 back then. Does that sound about right?
I don't know. I just know he was old.
Ed was a cocaine addict, right?
Yes, he did drugs.
So he used cocaine, not marijuana, right?
I don't know what drugs he did.
You don't remember saying he was using marijuana?
I probably said it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, he didn't use marijuana. He used cocaine, right?
I don't know what all drugs Ed used. I just know he does drugs.
So you don't know what Ed was using, is that right?
I don't know all the drugs Ed does. I don't.
So when you told the jury Ed was using marijuana, that was not true?
Yes, he was smoking marijuana.
So Ed was smoking marijuana, that's what you're saying?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and you know that Ed was a cocaine user, right?
No, ma'am, I don't know all the drugs.
You didn't know that Ed was a heroin user, is that right?
No, ma'am.
You didn't know that Ed was a sex offender?
No, ma'am. I never asked him.
You didn't know any of that?
I didn't get into his background or ask all of that. I just wanted work done on my van.
We found this whole exchange kind of odd. We We weren't quite sure what Ed, being a cocaine addict or a sex offender, really had to do with Darren's story. If anything, the fact that Laura Buck was citing Ed's criminal history made it seem like Ed was, in fact, a real person, which we really weren't sure of before. We sort of wondered if he'd be the next witness called by the defense once Laura Buck finished cross-examining Darren Wendt.
Now, I just want to ask you, I guess, a couple questions again in terms of information that you've had available to you in this case. As early as May 21st of 2015, the day that you were arrested, you knew that the government had information that you were radio silent on the internet, on your phone and computer for 36 hours on May 13th and 14th of 2015. You knew that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you knew more recently, but at least months ago, that the government had talked to family members of yours about whether or not they knew where you were during that time frame, right?
I would assume, yes, ma'am.
Well, not assume, you knew, right?
My sisters and brothers, yes, ma'am.
Sisters, brothers, mother, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Father?
Father, stepmother.
Right, everybody, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You knew that none of these people could provide you with an alibi?
Yes, ma'am.
Right, and so you're testifying now that it was Ed whose house you were at on May 13th and 14th.
Yes, ma'am.
So I guess the point is, the 52-year-old addict, that's where you went to hang out because you were so disappointed.
Yes, ma'am. There's a lot of people that goes over there to hang out.
Ed's the kind of guy that'll fix the van on the side for a couple of extra dollars, is that right?
Yes, he does mechanics.
And he's the kind of guy that'll pretty much do anything on a car if you give him some money for it, right?
As long as he knows how to do it, he will give you a price. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. He'll do anything for a couple of bucks, right?
Mechanical. That's all I know about. Working on cars for money.
He'll do anything related to a car for money.
Yes, ma'am.
And just to be clear, I guess you know Ed's dead, right?
No, ma'am.
Our jaws dropped. I remember turning to look at the reporter sitting next to me with eyes wide. Were we hearing this right? Ed is dead?
You didn't know Ed died a year ago.
No, ma'am. I don't have no... I couldn't call Ed when I was locked up. Ed don't have a phone.
You had no idea?
No, ma'am.
The one person who could provide Darren Wendt with an alibi wasn't going to testify. On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, more details are revealed as the cross-examination of Darren Wendt heats up.
You didn't come up with a timeline.
I'm just telling you the truth of when Darrell actually showed up.
You haven't been sitting over here writing a timeline?
22 Hours, An American Nightmare was written and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks to Lauren Larson and Claude Jennings for reading the testimony. And thank you for listening. Don't forget to rate this podcast and subscribe. We have the full transcript of Darren's cross-examination at 22hourspodcast.com. You can also send us feedback there or on Twitter at 22hourspod. We're working on an episode about unanswered questions, so if you have any, send them our way. You can email us too at podcast@wtop.com. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Cast of Pods by Doug Maxwell, and Spookster by Wayne Jones. Both available in the YouTube audio library. And Rhythmic Pulse by Daniel Birch, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.